Elizabeth Wharton, Hodges says. Wonder if she's still alive.
I'm pretty sure she is.
Because she had terrible scoliosis, Hodges takes a little hunched-over walk to demonstrate. If you want to get, you have to give.
Is that so? Too bad. Anyway, Helen, Mrs. Wilcox, says that Ms. Patterson visited as regular as clockwork, just like Mrs. Trelawney did until a month ago, that is. Then things must have got worse, because I believe the old lady's now in a nursing home in Warsaw County. Ms. Patterson moved into the condo herself, and that's where she is now. I still see her every now and then, though. Last time was a week ago when the real estate guy showed the house.
Hodges decides he's gotten everything he can reasonably expect from Radney Peoples.
Thanks for the update. I'm going to roll. Sorry we kind of got off on the wrong foot. Not at all, Peoples says, giving Hodges' offered hand two brisk pumps. You handle it like a pro. Just remember, I never said anything. Janelle Patterson may be living downtown, but she's still part of the association, and that makes her a client.
You never said a word, Hodges says, getting back into his car.
He hopes that Helen Wilcox's husband won't catch his wife and this beefcake in the sack together, if that is indeed going on. It would probably be the end of Vigilant Guard Service's arrangement with the residents of Sugar Heights. Peoples himself would immediately be terminated for cause. About that, there is no doubt at all.
Probably she just trots out to his car with fresh-baked cookies, Hodges thinks as he drives away. You've been watching too much Nazi couples therapy on afternoon TV. Not that Radney Peoples' love life matters to him.
What matters to Hodges as he heads back to his much humbler home on the west side is that Janelle Patterson inherited her sister's estate. Janelle Patterson is living right here in town, at least for the time being. And Janelle Patterson must have done something with the late Olivia Trelawney's possessions. That would include her personal papers, and her personal papers might contain a letter, possibly more than one, from the Freako, who has reached out to Hodges. If such correspondence exists, he would like to see it. Of course, this is police business, and K. William Hodges is no longer a policeman. By pursuing it, he is skating well beyond the bounds of what is legal, and he knows it. For one thing, he is withholding evidence, but he has no intention of stopping just yet. The cocky arrogance of the Freako's letter has pissed him off, but he admits it's pissed him off in a good way. It's given him a sense of purpose, and after the last few months, that seems like a pretty terrific thing. If I do happen to make a little progress, I'll turn the whole thing over to Pete. He's not looking in the rearview mirror as this thought crosses his mind, but if he had been, he would have seen his eyes flick momentarily up and to the left.
4. Hodges parks his Toyota in the sheltering overhang to the left of his house that serves as his garage and pauses to admire his freshly cut lawn before going to the door. There he finds a note sticking out of the mail slot. His first thought is Mr. Mercedes, but such a thing would be bold even for that guy.
It's from Jerome. His neat printing contrasts wildly with the bullshit jive of the message.
Dear Master Hodges, I has mowed your grass and put the mower back in your carpote. I hopes you didn't run over it, sir. If you has any more chores for this here black boy, hit me on my honker. I'd be happy to talk to you if I is not on de job with one of my hoes. As you know, they needs a lot of work and sometimes some tuning up on them, as they can be uppity, especially them high yellers. I is always here for you, sir. Jerome.
Hodges shakes his head wearily but can't help smiling. His hired kid gets straight A's in advanced math. He can replace fallen gutters. He fixes Hodges' email when it goes bluey, as it frequently does, mostly due to his own mismanagement. He can do basic plumbing. He can speak French pretty well. And if you ask what he's reading, he's apt to bore you for half an hour with the blood symbolism of D.H. Lawrence. He doesn't want to be white, but being a gifted black male in an upper-middle-class family has presented him with what he calls identity challenges. He says this in a joking way, but Hodges does not believe he's joking, not really. Jerome's college professor dad and CPA mom, both humor-challenged in Hodges' opinion, would no doubt be aghast at this communication. They might even feel their son in need of psychological counseling, but they won't find out from Hodges.
Jerome, 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 he says, letting himself in. Jerome and his chose for hoes.
Jerome, who can't decide, at least not yet, on which Ivy League college he wants to attend, that any of the big boys will accept him is a foregone conclusion. He's the only person in the neighborhood whom Hodges thinks of as a friend, and really, the only one he needs. Hodges believes friendship is overrated, and in this way, if in no other, he is like Brady Hartsfield. He has made it in time for most of the evening news, but decides against it. There's only so much Gulf oil spill and Tea Party politics he can take. He turns on his computer instead, launches Firefox, and plugs Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella into the search field. There are only 6 results, a very small catch in the vast, fishy sea of the Internet, and only one that matches the phrase exactly. Hodges clicks on it, and a picture appears. Under a sky filled with threatening clouds is a country hillside. Animated rain, a simple repeating loop, he judges, is pouring down in silvery streams. But the 2 people seated beneath a large blue umbrella, a young man and a young woman, are safe and dry. They are not kissing, but their heads are close together. They appear to be in deep conversation. Below the picture, there's a brief description of the blue umbrella's raison d'etre. Unlike sites such as Facebook and LinkedIn, Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella is a chat site where old friends can meet and new friends can get to know one another in total guaranteed anonymity. No pictures, no porn, no 140-character tweets, just good old-fashioned conversation. Below this is a button marked, Get Started Now. Hodges mouses his cursor onto it, then hesitates. About 6 months ago, Jerome had to delete his email address and give him a new one because everyone in Hodges' address book had gotten a message saying he was stranded in New York, someone had stolen his wallet with all his credit cards inside, and he needed money to get home. Would the email recipient please send $50, more if he or she could afford it, to a mailboxes, etc. in Tribeca? I'll pay you back as soon as I get this mess straightened out, the message concluded. Hodges was deeply embarrassed because the begging request had gone out to his ex, his brother in Toledo, and better than 4 dozen cops he'd worked with over the years. Also his daughter. He had expected his phone, both landline and cell, to ring like crazy for the next 48 hours or so, but very few people called, and only Allison seemed actually concerned. This didn't surprise him. Allie, a gloomy Gus by nature, has been expecting her father to lose his shit ever since he turned 55. Hodges had called on Jerome for help, and Jerome explained he had been a victim of phishing. Mostly the people who fish your address just want to sell Viagra and knock off jewelry, but I've seen this kind before, too. It happened to my environmental studies teacher, and he ended up paying people back almost $1,000. Of course, that was in the old days, before people wised up. Old days meaning exactly when, Jerome? Jerome had shrugged. 2-3 years ago? It's a new world out there, Mr. Hodges. Just be grateful the fisherman didn't hit you with a virus that ate all your files and apps. I wouldn't lose much, Hodges had said. Mostly I just surf the web, although I would miss the computer solitaire. It plays Happy Days Are Here Again when I win. Jerome had given him his patented, I'm too polite to call you dumb look. What about your tax returns? I helped you do them online last year. You want someone to see what you paid Uncle Sugar? Besides me, I mean? Hodges admitted he didn't. In that strange and somehow endearing pedagogical voice the intelligent young always seemed to employ when endeavoring to educate the clueless old, Jerome said, Your computer isn't just a new kind of TV set. Get that out of your mind. Every time you turn it on, you're opening a window into your life. If someone wants to look, that is. All this goes through his head as he looks at the blue umbrella and the endlessly falling rain. Other stuff goes through it, too, stuff from his cop mind, which had been asleep but is now wide awake. Maybe Mr. Mercedes wants to talk. On the other hand, maybe what he really wants is to look through that window Jerome was talking about. Instead of clicking on Get Started Now, Hodges exits the site, grabs his phone, and punches one of the few numbers he has on speed dial. Jerome's mother answers, and after some brief and pleasant chit-chat, she hands off to young Mr. Cho's for hose himself. Speaking in the most horrible Ebonics dialect he can manage, Hodges says,
Yo, my homie, you keeping them bitches in line? They earning? You representing?
Oh, hi, Mr. Hodges. Yes, everything's fine.
You don't like me talking this way on your honker, bruh?
Jerome is honestly flummoxed and Hodges takes pity on him. The lawn looks terrific. Oh, good. Thanks. Can I do anything else for you?
Maybe so. I was wondering if you could come by after school tomorrow. It's a computer thing.
Sure. What's the problem this time?
I'd rather not discuss it on the phone, Hodges says. But you might find it interesting.
4 o'clock, okay? That works.
Good. Do me a favor and leave Tyrone Feelgood Delight at home.
Okay, Mr. Hodges, will do.
When are you going to lighten up and call me Bill? Mr. Hodges makes me feel like your American history teacher.
Maybe when I'm out of high school, Jerome says very seriously.
Just as long as you know you can make the jump anytime you want.
Jerome laughs. The kid has got a great full laugh. Hearing it always cheers Hodges up. He sits at the computer desk in his little cubbyhole of an office, drumming his fingers, thinking. It occurs to him that he hardly ever uses this room during the evening. If he wakes at 2 a.m. and can't get back to sleep, yes, he'll come in and play solitaire for an hour or so before returning to bed, but he's usually in his lazy boy between 7 and midnight, watching old movies on AMC or TCM and stuffing his face with fats and sugars. He grabs his phone again, dials directory assistance, and asks the robot on the other end if it has a number for Janelle Patterson. He's not hopeful. Now that she is the $7 million woman and newly divorced in the bargain, Mrs. Trelawney's sister has probably got an unlisted number. But the robot coughs it up. Hodges is so surprised he has to fumble for a pencil and then punch 2 for a repeat. He drums his fingers some more, thinking how he wants to approach her. It will probably come to nothing, but it would be his next step if he were still on the cops. Since he's not, it will take a little extra finesse. He is amused to discover how eagerly he welcomes this challenge.
5. Brady calls ahead to Sammy's Pizza on his way home and picks up a small pepperoni and mushroom pie. If he thought his mother would eat a couple of slices, he would have gotten a bigger one, but he knows better. Maybe if it was pepperoni and Popov, he thinks. If they sold that, I'd have to skip the medium and go straight to a large. There are tract houses on the city's north side. They were built between Korea and Vietnam, which means they all look the same and they're all turning to shit. Most still have plastic toys on the crabgrassy lawns, although it's now full dark. Chaz Hartsfield is at 49 Elm Street, where there are no elms and probably never were. It's just that all the streets in this area of the city, known reasonably enough as Northfield, are named for trees. Brady parks behind Ma's rust bucket Honda, which needs a new exhaust system, new points, and new plugs, not to mention an inspection sticker. Let her take care of it, Brady thinks, but she won't. He will. He'll have to, the way he takes care of everything. The way I took care of Frankie, he thinks, back when the basement was just the basement instead of my control center. Brady and Deborah Ann Hartsfield don't talk about Frankie. The door is locked. At least he's taught her that much, although God knows it hasn't been easy. She's the kind of person who thinks okay solves all of life's problems. Tell her, put the half and half back in the fridge after you use it, she says okay. Then you come home and there it sits on the counter, going sour. You say, please do a wash so I can have a clean uni for the ice cream truck tomorrow, she says okay. But when you poke your head into the laundry room, everything's still there in the basket. The cackle of the TV greets him. Something about an immunity challenge, so it's Survivor. He has tried to tell her it's all fake, a setup. She says yes, okay, she knows, but she still never misses it. I'm home, Ma. Hi, honey. Only a moderate slur, which is good for this hour of the evening. If I was her liver, Brady thinks, I'd jump out of her mouth some night while she's snoring and run the fuck away. He nonetheless feels that little flicker of anticipation as he goes into the living room, the flicker he hates. She's sitting on the couch in the white silk robe he got her for Christmas, and he can see more white where it splits apart high up on her thighs. Her underwear. He refuses to think the word panties in connection with his mother. It's too sexy, but it's down there in his mind just the same. A snake hiding in poisoned sumac. Also, he can see the small round shadows of her nipples. It's not right that such things should turn him on. She's pushing 50. She's starting to flab out around the middle. She's his mother, for God's sake, but... I brought pizza, he says, holding up the box and thinking, I already ate. I already ate, she says. Probably she did. A few lettuce leaves and a teensy tub of yogurt. It's how she keeps what's left of her figure. It's your favorite, he says, thinking, you enjoy it, honey. You enjoy it, sweetie, she says. She lifts her glass and takes a ladylike sip. Gulping comes later after he's gone to bed and she thinks he's asleep. Get yourself a Coke and come sit beside me. She pats the couch. Her robe opens a little more. White robe. White panties. Underwear, he reminds himself. Underwear, that's all. She's my mother. She's Ma. And when it's your Ma, it's just underwear. She sees him looking and smiles. She does not adjust the robe. The survivors are on Fiji this year, she frowns. I think it's Fiji. One of those islands, anyway. Come and watch with me. Nah, I guess I'll go downstairs and work for a while. What project is this, honey? A new kind of router. She wouldn't know a router from a grouter, so that's safe enough. One of these days, you'll invent something that will make us rich, she says. I know you will. Then goodbye, electronics store, and goodbye to that ice cream truck. She looks at him with wide eyes that are only a little watery from the vodka. He doesn't know how much she puts down in the course of an ordinary day, and counting empty bottles doesn't work because she ditches them somewhere, but he knows her capacity is staggering. Thanks, he says, feeling flattered in spite of himself, feeling other stuff too, very much in spite of himself. Come give your Ma a kiss, honey boy. He approaches the couch, careful not to look down the front of the gaping robe and trying to ignore that crawling sensation just below his belt buckle. She turns her face to one side, but when he bends to kiss her cheek, she turns back and presses her damp, half-open mouth to his. He tastes booze and smells the perfume she always dabs behind her ears. She dabs at other places as well. She places a palm on the nape of his neck and ruffles his hair with the tips of her fingers, sending a shiver all the way down to the small of his back. She touches his upper lip with the tip of her tongue, just a flick there and gone, then pulls back and gives him the wide-eyed starlet stare. My honey boy, she breathes, like the heroine of some romantic chick flick, the kind where the men wave swords and the women wear low-cut dresses with their cakes pushed up into shimmery globes. He pulls away hastily. She smiles at him, then looks back at the TV where good-looking young people in bathing suits are running along a beach. He opens the pizza box with hands that are shaking slightly, takes out a slice and drops it in her salad bowl. Eat that, he says. It'll sop up the booze, some of it. Don't be mean to Mommy, she says, but with no rancor and certainly no hurt. She pulls her robe closed, doing it absently, already lost in the world of the survivors again, intent on discovering who will be voted off the island this week. And don't forget about my car, Brady. It needs a sticker. It needs a lot more than that, he says, and goes into the kitchen. He grabs a Coke from the fridge, then opens the door to the basement. He stands there in the dark for a moment, then speaks a single word. Control. Below him, the fluorescents, he installed them himself, just as he remodeled the basement himself, flash on. At the foot of the stairs, he thinks of Frankie. He almost always does when he stands in the place where Frankie died. The only time he didn't think of Frankie was when he was preparing to make his run at City Center. During those weeks, everything else left his mind, and what a relief that was. Brady, Frankie said. His last word on planet Earth. Gurgles and gasps didn't count. He puts his pizza and his soda on the work table in the middle of the room, then goes into the closet-sized bathroom and drops trowel. He won't be able to eat, won't be able to work on his new project, which is certainly not a router. He won't be able to think until he takes care of some urgent business. In his letter to the FedEx cop, he stated he was so sexually excited when he crashed into the job seekers at City Center that he was wearing a condom. He further stated that he masturbates while reliving the event. If that were true, it would give a whole new meaning to the term autoerotic, but it isn't. He lied a lot in that letter. Each lie calculated to wind Hodges up a little more, and his bogus sex fantasies weren't the greatest of them. He actually doesn't have much interest in girls, and girls sense it. It's probably why he gets along so well with Freddie Linklater, his cyber dyke colleague at Discount Electronics. For all Brady knows, she might think he's gay. But he's not gay either. He's largely a mystery to himself, an occluded front. But one thing he knows for sure, he's not asexual, or not completely. He and his mother share a gothic rainbow of a secret, a thing not to be thought of unless it is absolutely necessary. When it does become necessary, it must be dealt with and put away again. "Ma, I see your panties," he thinks, and takes care of his business as fast as he can. There's Vaseline in the medicine cabinet, but he doesn't use it. He wants it to burn. 6. Back in his roomy basement workspace, Brady speaks another word. This one is chaos. On the far side of the control room is a long shelf about 3 feet above the floor. Ranged along it are 7 laptop computers with their darkened screens flipped up. There's also a chair on casters so he can roll rapidly from one to another. When Brady speaks the magic word, all 7 come to life. The number 20 appears on each screen, then 19, then 18. If he allows this countdown to reach 0, a suicide program will kick in, scrubbing his hard disks clean and overwriting them with gibberish. "Darkness," he says, and the big countdown numbers disappear, replaced by desktop images that show scenes from The Wild Bunch, his favorite movie. He tried Apocalypse and Armageddon, much better startup words in his opinion, full of ringing finality, but the word recognition program has problems with them, and the last thing he wants is having to replace all his files because of a stupid glitch. 2-syllable words are safer. Not that there's much on 6 of the 7 computers. Number 3 is the only one with what the fat ex-cop would call incriminating information, but he likes to look at that awesome array of computing power, all lit up as it is now. It makes the basement room feel like a real command center. Brady considers himself a creator, as well as a destroyer, but knows that so far he hasn't managed to create anything that will exactly set the world on fire, and he's haunted by the possibility that he never will, that he has at best a second-rate creative mind. Take the Rola, for instance. That had come to him in a flash of inspiration one night when he'd been vacuuming the living room, like using the washing machine, such a chore as usually beneath his mother. He had sketched a device that looked like a footstool on bearings, with a motor and a short hose attachment on the underside. With the addition of a simple computer program, Brady reckoned the device could be designed to move around a room, vacuuming as it went. If it hit an obstacle, a chair, say, or a wall, it would turn on its own and start off in a new direction. He had actually begun building a prototype when he saw a version of his Rola trundling busily around the window display of an upscale appliance store downtown. The name was even similar. It was called a Roomba. Someone had beaten him to it, and that someone was probably making millions. It wasn't fair, but what is? Life is a crap carnival with shit prizes. He has blue-boxed the TVs in the house, which means Brady and his ma are getting not just basic cable, but all the premium channels, including a few exotic add-ins like Al Jazeera, for free, and there's not a damn thing Time Warner, Comcast, or Xfinity can do about it. He has hacked the DVD player so it will run not just American discs, but those from every region of the world. It's easy. 3 or 4 quick steps with the remote, plus a 6-digit recognition code. Great in theory. But does it get used? Not at 49 Elm Street, it doesn't. Ma won't watch anything that isn't spoon-fed to her by the four major networks, and Brady himself is mostly working one of his two jobs or down here in the control room where he does his actual work. The blue boxes are great, but they're also illegal. For all he knows, the DVD hacks are illegal, too, not to mention his Redbox and Netflix hacks. All his best ideas are illegal. Take Thing One and Thing Two. Thing One had been on the passenger seat of Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes when he left City Center on that foggy morning the previous April, with blood dripping from the bent grill and stippling the windshield. The idea came to him during the murky period 3 years ago after he had decided to kill a whole bunch of people, what he then thought of as his terrorist run, but before he had decided just how, when, or where to do it. He had been full of ideas then, jittery, not sleeping much. In those days he always felt as though he had just swallowed a whole thermos of black coffee laced with amphetamines. Thing One was a modified TV remote with a microchip for a brain and a battery pack to boost its range, although the range was still pretty short. If you pointed it at a traffic light 20 or 30 yards away, you could change red to yellow with one tap, red to blinking yellow with two taps, and red to green with three. Brady was delighted with it and had used it several times, always while sitting parked in his old Subaru. The ice cream truck was far too conspicuous, at busy intersections. After several near misses, he had finally caused an actual accident. Just a fender bender. But it had been fun to watch the two men arguing about whose fault it had been. For a while, it had looked like they might actually come to blows. Thing Two came shortly afterward, but it was Thing One that settled Brady on his target because it radically upped the chances of a successful getaway. The distance between City Center and the abandoned warehouse he had picked as a dumping spot for Mrs. Trelawney's gray Mercedes was exactly 1.9 miles. There were 8 traffic lights along the route he planned to take, and with his splendid gadget, he wouldn't have to worry about any of them. But on that morning, Jesus Christ, wouldn't you know it, every one of those lights had been green. Brady understood the early hour had something to do with it, but it was still infuriating. If I hadn't had it, he thinks as he goes to the closet at the far end of the basement, at least 4 of those lights would have been red. That's the way my life works. Thing Two was the only one of his gadgets that turned out to be an actual moneymaker. Not big money, but as everyone knew, money isn't everything. Besides, without Thing Two, there would have been no Mercedes. And with no Mercedes, no City Center Massacre. Good old Thing Two. A big Yale padlock hangs from the hasp of the closet door. Brady opens it with a key on his ring. The lights inside, more new fluorescents, are already on. The closet is small and made even smaller by the plain board shelves. On one of them are 9 shoeboxes. Inside each box is a pound of homemade plastic explosive. Brady has tested some of this stuff at an abandoned gravel pit far out in the country, and it works just fine. If I was over there in Afghanistan, he thinks, dressed in a head rag and one of those funky bathrobes, I could have quite a career blowing up troop carriers. On another shelf, in another shoebox, are 5 cell phones. They're the disposable kind the low-town drug dealers call burners. The phones, available at fine drugstores and convenience stores everywhere, are Brady's project for tonight. They have to be modified so that a single number will ring all of them, creating the proper spark needed to detonate the boom clay in the shoeboxes at the same time. He hasn't actually decided to use the plastic, but part of him wants to. Yes, indeed. He told the FedEx cop he has no urge to replicate his masterpiece, but that was another lie. A lot depends on the FedEx cop himself. If he does what Brady wants, as Mrs. Trelawney did what Brady wanted, he's sure the urge will go away, at least for a while. If not, well, he grabs the box of phones, starts out the closet, then pauses and looks back. On one of the other shelves is a quilted woodman's vest from L.L. Bean. If Brady were really going out in the woods, a medium would suit him fine. He's slim, but this one is an XL. On the breast is a smile decal, the one wearing dark glasses and showing its teeth. The vest holds 4 more 1-pound blocks of plastic explosive, 2 in the outside pockets, 2 in the slash pockets on the inside. The body of the vest bulges because it's filled with ball bearings, just like the ones in Hodge's happy slapper. Brady slashed the lining to pour them in. It even crossed his mind to ask Ma to sew the slashes up, and that gave him a good laugh as he sealed them shut with duct tape. "My very own suicide vest," he thinks affectionately. He won't use it. Probably won't use it. But this idea also has a certain attraction. It would put an end to everything. No more discount electronics. No more cyber patrol calls to dig peanut butter or saltine crumbs out of some elderly idiot's CPU. No more ice cream truck. Also, no more crawling snakes in the back of his mind or under his belt buckle. He imagines doing it at a rock concert. He knows Springsteen is going to play Lakefront Arena this June. Or how about the 4th of July parade down Lake Street, the city's main drag? Or maybe an opening day of the Summer Sidewalk Art Festival and Street Fair, which happens every year on the first Saturday in August. That would be good, except wouldn't he look funny wearing a quilted vest on a hot August afternoon? True, but such things can always be worked out by the creative mind, he thinks, spreading the disposable phones on his work table and beginning to remove the SIM cards. Besides, the suicide vest is just a, what do you call it? Doomsday scenario. It will probably never be used. Nice to have it handy, though. Before going upstairs, he sits down at his number 3, goes online, and checks the blue umbrella. Nothing from the fat ex-cop. Yet.
7. When Hodges uses the intercom outside Mrs. Warden's Lake Avenue condo at 10 the next morning, he's wearing a suit for only the second or third time since he retired. It feels good to be in a suit again, even though it's tight at the waist and under the arms. A man in a suit feels like a working man.
A woman's voice comes from the speaker. Yes?
It's Bill Hodges, ma'am. We spoke last night.
So we did, and you're right on time. It's 19C, Detective Hodges.
He starts to tell her that he's no longer a detective, but the door is buzzing, and so he doesn't bother. Besides, he told her he was retired when they talked on the phone. Janelle Patterson is waiting for him at the door, just as her sister was on the day of the city center massacre when Hodges and Pete Huntley came to interview her the first time. The resemblance between the two women is enough to give Hodges a powerful sense of deja vu. But as he makes his way down the short hall from the elevator to the apartment doorway, trying to walk rather than lumber, he sees that the differences outweigh the similarities. Patterson has the same light blue eyes and high cheekbones, but where Olivia Trelawney's mouth was tight and pinched, the lips often white with a combination of strain and irritation, Janelle Patterson seemed, even in repose, ready to smile. Or to bestow a kiss. Her lips are shiny with what look gloss. They look good enough to eat. And no boat-neck tops for this lady. She's wearing a snug turtleneck that cradles a pair of perfectly round breasts. They are not big, those breasts, but as Hodges' dear old father used to say, more than a handful is wasted. Is he looking at the work of good foundation garments or a post-divorce enhancement? Enhancement seems more likely to Hodges. Thanks to her sister, she can afford all the bodywork she wants. She extends her hand and gives him a good no-nonsense shake.
Thank you for coming.
As if it had been at her request. Glad you could see me, he says, following her in. That same kick-ass view of the lake smacks him in the face. He remembers it well, although they had only the one interview with Mrs. T here. All the others were either at the big house in Sugar Heights or at the station. She had gone into hysterics during one of those station visits, he remembers. Everybody is blaming me, she said. The suicide had come not much later, only a matter of weeks.
Would you like coffee, Detective? It's Jamaican. Very tasty, I think.
Hodges makes it a habit not to drink coffee in the middle of the morning because doing so usually gives him savage acid reflux in spite of his Zantac, but he agrees. He sits in one of the sling chairs by the wide living room window while he waits for her to come back from the kitchen.
The day is warm and clear. On the lake, sailboats are zipping and curving like skaters. When she returns, he stands up to take the silver tray she's carrying, but Janelle smiles, shakes her head no, and sets it on the low coffee table with a graceful dip of her knees, almost a curtsy. Hodges has considered every possible twist and turn their conversation might take, but his forethought turns out to be irrelevant. It is as if, after carefully planning a seduction, the object of his desire has met him at the door in a shorty nightgown and fuck-me shoes.
"I want to find out who drove my sister to suicide," she says as she pours their coffee into stout china mugs. "But I didn't know how I should proceed. Your call was like a message from God. After our conversation, I think you're the man for the job."
Hodges is too dumbfounded to speak. She offers him a mug.
"If you want cream, you'll have to pour it yourself. When it comes to additives, I take no responsibility."
"Black is fine."
She smiles. Her teeth are either perfect or perfectly capped. "A man after my own heart."
He sips, mostly to buy time, but the coffee is delicious.
He clears his throat and says,
"As I told you when we talked last night, Mrs. Patterson, I'm no longer a police detective. On November 20th of last year, I became just another private citizen. We need to have that up front."
She regards him over the rim of her cup. Hodges wonders if the moist gloss on her lips leaves an imprint, or if lipstick technology has rendered that sort of thing obsolete. It's a crazy thing to be wondering, but she's a pretty lady. Also, he doesn't get out much these days. "As far as I'm concerned," Janelle Patterson says, "there are only two words that matter in what you just said. One is private, and the other is detective. I want to know who meddled with her, who toyed with her until she killed herself, and nobody in the police department cares. They'd like to catch the man who used her car to kill those people, oh yes. But about my sister, may I be vulgar, they don't give a shit."
Hodges may be retired, but he still has his loyalties. "That isn't necessarily true."
"I understand why you'd say that, detective."
"Mister, please, just Mr. Hodges. Or Bill, if you like."
"Bill, then. And it is true. There's a connection between those murders and my sister's suicide, because the man who used the car is also the man who wrote the letter. And those other things. Those blue umbrella things."
"Easy," Hodges cautions himself. "Don't blow it. What letter are we talking about, Mrs. Patterson?"
"Janie. If you're Bill, I'm Janie. Wait here, I'll show you."
She gets up and leaves the room. Hodge's heart is beating hard, much harder than when he took on the trolls beneath the underpass, but he still appreciates that the view of Janie Patterson going away is as good as the one from the front. "Easy, boy," he tells himself again and sips more coffee. "Philip Marlowe, you ain't." His mug is already half empty and no acid. Not a trace of it. Miracle coffee, he thinks. She comes back, holding two pieces of paper by the corners and with an expression of distaste.
"I found it when I was going through the papers in Ollie's desk. Her lawyer, Mr. Schran, was with me. She named him the executor of her will, so he had to be. But he was in the kitchen getting himself a glass of water. He never saw this. I hid it."
She says it matter-of-factly, with no shame or defiance.
"I knew what it was right away. Because of that. The guy left one on the steering wheel of her car. I guess you could call it his calling card."
She taps the sunglasses-wearing smile face partway down the first page of the letter. Hodges has already noted it. He has also noted the letter's font, which he has identified from his own word processing program as American Typewriter. "When did you find it?"
She thinks back, calculating the passage of time. "I came for the funeral, which was near the end of November. I discovered that I was Ollie's sole beneficiary when the will was read. That would have been the first week of December. I asked Mr. Schran if we could put off the inventory of Ollie's assets and possessions until January, because I had some business to take care of back in L.A. He agreed." She looks at Hodges, a level stare from blue eyes with a bright sparkle in them. "The business I had to take care of was divorcing my husband, who was, may I be vulgar again, a philandering, coke-snorting asshole."
Hodges has no desire to go down this sidetrack. "You returned to Sugar Heights in January?"
"Yes."
"And found the letter then?"
"Yes."
"Have the police seen it?"
He knows the answer. January was over 4 months ago, but the question has to be asked.
No.
Why not?
I already told you. Because I don't trust them.
That bright sparkle in her eyes overspills as she begins to cry. 8. She asks if he will excuse her. Hodges tells her of course. She disappears, presumably to get control of herself and repair her face. Hodges picks up the letter and reads it, taking small sips of coffee as he does so. The coffee really is delicious. Now, if he just had a cookie or two to go with it.
Dear Olivia Trelawney, I hope you will read this letter all the way to the end before throwing it away or burning it up. I know I don't deserve your consideration, but I am begging for it just the same. You see, I am the man who stole your Mercedes and drove it into those people. Now I am burning like you might burn my letter, only with shame and remorse and sorrow. Please, please, please give me a chance to explain. I can never have your forgiveness. That's another thing I know, and I don't expect it. But if I can only get you to understand, that would be enough. Will you give me that chance? Please. To the public, I am a monster. To the TV news, I'm just another bloody story to sell commercials. To the police, I am just another perk they want to catch and put in jail. But I am also a human being, just as you are. Here is my story. I grew up in a physically and sexually abusive household. My stepfather was the first. And do you know what happened when my mother found out? She joined the fun. Have you stopped reading yet? I wouldn't blame you. It's disgusting, but I hope you have not, because I have to get this off my chest. I may not be in the land of the living much longer, you see, but I cannot end my life without someone knowing why I did what I did. Not that I understand it completely myself, but perhaps you, as an outsider, will. Here was Mr. Smiley Face. The sexual abuse went on until my stepfather died of a heart attack when I was 12. My mother said if I ever told, I would be blamed. She said if I showed the healed cigarette burns on my arms and legs and privates, she would tell people I did it myself. I was just a kid, and I thought she was telling the truth. She also told me that if people did believe me, she would have to go to jail, and I would be put in an orphan home, which was probably true. I kept my mouth shut. Sometimes the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. I never grew very much, and I was very thin because I was too nervous to eat, and when I did, I often threw up. Bulimia. Hence, and because of this, I was bullied at school. I also developed a bunch of nervous tics, such as picking at my clothes and pulling at my hair, sometimes pulling it out in bunches. This caused me to be laughed at, not just by the other kids, but by teachers too.
Janie Patterson has returned and is once again sitting opposite him, drinking her coffee, but for the moment Hodges barely notices her. He's thinking back to the 4 or 5 interviews he and Pete conducted with Mrs. T. He's remembering how she was always straightening the boat neck tops, or tugging down her skirt, or touching the corners of her pinched mouth as if to remove a crumb of lipstick, or winding a curl of hair around her finger and tugging at it, that too. He goes back to the letter.
I was never a mean kid, Mrs. Trelawney. I swear to you. I never tortured animals or beat up kids that were even smaller than I was. I was just a scurrying little mouse of a kid trying to get through my childhood without being laughed at or humiliated. But at that, I did not succeed. I wanted to go to college, but I never did. You see, I ended up taking care of the woman who abused me. It's almost funny, isn't it? Ma had a stroke, possibly because of her drinking. Yes, she is also an alcoholic, or was when she could get to the store to buy her bottles. She can walk a little, but really not much. I have to help her to the toilet and clean her up after she does her business. I work all day at a low-paying job, probably lucky to have a job at all in this economy, I know, and then come home and take care of her, because having a woman come in for a few hours on weekdays is all I can afford. It is a bad and stupid life. I have no friends and no possibility of advancement where I work. If society is a beehive, then I am just another drone. Finally, I began to get angry. I wanted to make someone pay. I wanted to strike back at the world and make the world know I was alive. Can you understand that? Have you ever felt like that? Most likely not, as you are wealthy and probably have the best friends money can buy.
Following this zinger, there's another of those sunglasses-wearing smile faces, as if to say, just kidding.
One day, it all got to be too much, and I did what I did. I didn't plan ahead.
The fuck you didn't, Hodges thinks.
And I thought the chances were at least 50-50 that I would get caught. I didn't care. And I sure didn't know how it would haunt me afterward. I still relive the thuds that resulted from hitting them, and I still hear their screams. Then, when I saw the news and found out I had even killed a baby, it really came home to me what a terrible thing I had done. I don't know how I live with myself. Mrs. Trelawney, why did you leave your key in your ignition? If I had not seen that walking one early morning because I could not sleep, none of this would have happened. If you hadn't left your key in your ignition, that little baby and her mother would still be alive. I am not blaming you. I'm sure your mind was full of your own problems and anxieties, but I wish things had turned out different, and if you had remembered to take your key, they would have. I would not be burning in this hell of guilt and remorse. You are probably feeling guilt and remorse too, and I am sorry, especially because very soon you will find out how mean people can be. The TV news and the papers will talk about how your carelessness made my terrible act possible. Your friends will stop talking to you. The police will hound you. When you go to the supermarket, people will look at you and then whisper to each other. Some won't be content with just whispering and will get in your face. I would not be surprised if there was vandalism to your home, so tell your security people, I'm sure you have them, to watch out. I don't suppose you would want to talk to me, would you? Oh, I don't mean face to face, but there is a safe place, safe for both of us, where we could talk using our computers. It's called Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella. I even got you a username if you should want to do this. The username is OTRELAW19. I know what an ordinary person would do. An ordinary person would take this letter straight to the police. But let me ask a question. What have they done for you except hound you and cause you sleepless nights? Although here's a thought. If you want me dead, giving this letter to the police is the way to do it, as surely as putting a gun to my head and pulling the trigger, because I will kill myself. Crazy as it may seem, you are the only person keeping me alive. Because you are the only one I can talk to. The only one who understands what it is like to be in hell. Now I will wait. Mrs. Trelawney, I am so, so, so sorry.
Hodges puts the letter down on the coffee table and says, "Holy shit."
Janie Patterson nods.
That was pretty much my reaction.
He invited her to get in touch with him.
Janie gives him an incredulous look.
Invited her? Try blackmailed her. Do it or I'll kill myself?
According to you, she took him up on it. Have you seen any of their communications? Were there maybe printouts along with this letter?
She shakes her head.
Ollie told my mother that she'd been chatting with what she called a very disturbed man and trying to get him to seek help because he'd done a terrible thing. My mother was alarmed. She assumed Ollie was talking with the very disturbed man face to face, like in the park or a coffee shop or something. You have to remember she's in her late 80s now. She knows about computers, but she's vague on their practical uses. Ollie explained about chat rooms, or tried to, but I'm not sure how much Mom actually understood. What she remembers is that Ollie said she talked to the very disturbed man underneath a blue umbrella.
Did your mother connect the man to the stolen Mercedes and the killings at City Center?
She never said anything that would make me believe so. Her short-term memory's gotten very foggy. If you ask her about the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, she can tell you exactly when she heard the news on the radio and probably who the newscaster was. Ask her what she had for breakfast or even where she is, Janie shrugged. She might be able to tell you, she might not.
And where is she, exactly?
A place called Sunny Acres, about 30 miles from here.
She laughs, a rueful sound with no joy in it.
Whenever I hear the name, I think of those old melodramas you see on Turner Classic Movies where the heroine is declared insane and socked away in some awful, drafty madhouse. She turns to look out at the lake. Her face has taken on an expression Hodges finds interesting, a bit pensive and a bit defensive.
The more he looks at her, the more he likes her looks. The fine lines around her eyes suggest that she's a woman who likes to laugh.
I know who I'd be in one of those old movies, she says, still looking out at the boats playing on the water. The conniving sister who inherits the care of an elderly parent along with a pile of money. The cruel sister who keeps the money but ships the aged pea off to a creepy mansion where the old people get Alpo for dinner and are left to lie in their own urine all night. But Sonny's not like that. It's actually very nice. Not cheap, either. And Mom asked to go.
Yeah?
Yeah,
she says, mocking him with a little wrinkle of her nose.
Do you happen to remember her nurse, Mrs. Green? Althea Green?
Hodges catches himself reaching into his jacket to consult a case notebook that's no longer there, but after a moment's thought he recalls the nurse without it. A tall and stately woman in white who seemed to glide rather than walk, with a mass of marcelled gray hair that made her look a bit like Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. He and Pete had asked if she'd noticed Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes parked at the curb when she left on that Thursday night. She had replied she was quite sure she had, which to the team of Hodges and Huntley meant she wasn't sure at all. Yeah, I remember her.
She announced her retirement almost as soon as I moved back from Los Angeles. She said that at 64 she no longer felt able to deal competently with a patient suffering from such serious disabilities, and she stuck to her guns even after I offered to bring in a nurse's aide, two, if she wanted. I think she was appalled by the publicity that resulted from the City Center massacre. But if it had been only that, she might have stayed.
Your sister's suicide was the final straw.
I'm pretty sure it was. I won't say Althea and Ollie were bosom buddies or anything, but they got on, and they saw eye to eye about Mom's care. Now Sonny's the best thing for her, and Mom's relieved to be there. On her good days, at least. So am I. For one thing, they manage her pain better.
If I were to go out and talk to her...
She might remember a few things, or she might not. She turns from the lake to look at him directly. Will you take the job? I checked private detective rates online, and I'm prepared to do considerably better. $5,000 a week, plus expenses. An 8-week minimum.
$40,000 for 8 weeks' work, Hodges marvels. Maybe he could be Philip Marlowe after all. He imagines himself in a ratty two-room office that gives on the third-floor hallway of a cheap office building, hiring a vavoom receptionist with a name like Lola or Velma. A tough-talking blonde, of course. He'd wear a trench coat and a brown fedora on rainy days, the hat pulled down to one eyebrow. Ridiculous.
and not what attracts him. The attraction is not being in his Lazy Boy, watching the lady judge and stuffing his face with snacks. He also likes being in his suit. But there's more. He left the PD with strings dangling. Pete has ID'd the pawn shop armed robber, and it looks like he and Isabel James may soon be arresting Donald Davis, the mope who killed his wife and then went on TV flashing his handsome smile. Good for Pete and Izzy, but neither Davis or the pawn shop shotgunner is the big casino. Also, he thinks Mr. Mercedes should have left me alone. And Mrs. T. He should have left her alone, too.
Bill? Janie's snapping her fingers like a stage hypnotist bringing a subject out of a trance. Are you there, Bill?
He returns his attention to her, a woman in her mid-40s who's not afraid to sit in bright sunlight. If I say yes, you'll be hiring me as a security consultant.
She looks amused. Like the men who work for Vigilant Guard Service out in the Heights?
No, not like them. They're bonded, for one thing. I'm not. I never had to be, he thinks. I'd just be private security, like the kind of guys who work the downtown nightclubs. That's nothing you'd be able to claim as a deduction on your income tax, I'm afraid.
Amusement broadens into a smile, and she does the nose-wrinkling thing again. A fairly entrancing sight, in Hodge's opinion. Don't care. In case you didn't know, I'm rolling in dough.
What I'm trying for is full disclosure, Janie. I have no private detective's license, which won't stop me from asking questions, but how well I can operate without either a badge or a PI ticket remains to be seen. It's like asking a blind man to stroll around town without his guide dog.
Surely there's a police department old boys network.
There is, but if I tried to use it, I'd be putting both the old boys and myself in a bad position. That he has already done this by pumping Pete for information is a thing he won't share with her on such short acquaintance. He lifts the letter Janie has showed him. For one thing, I'm guilty of withholding evidence if I agree to keep this between us.
That he's already withholding a similar letter is another thing she doesn't need to know.
Technically, at least. And withholding is a felony offense.
She looks dismayed. Oh my God, I never thought of that.
On the other hand, I doubt if there's much forensics could do with it. A letter dropped into a mailbox on Marlborough Street or Lowbriar Avenue is just about the most anonymous thing in the world. Once upon a time, I remember it well, you could match up the typing in a letter to the machine that wrote it. If you could find the machine, that is. It was as good as a fingerprint.
But this wasn't typed.
Nope. Laser printer. Which means no hanging A's or crooked T's, so I wouldn't be withholding much. Of course, withholding is still withholding. I'm going to take the job, Janie, but $5,000 a week is ridiculous. I'll take a check for two, if you want to write one, and bill you for expenses.
That doesn't seem like anywhere near enough.
If I get someplace, we can talk about a bonus. But he doesn't think he'll take one, even if he does manage to run Mr. Mercedes to ground. Not when he came here already determined to investigate the bastard and to sweet-talk her into helping him.
All right. Agreed. And thank you.
Welcome. Now, tell me about your relationship with Olivia. All I know is it was good enough for you to call her Ollie, and I could use more.
That will take some time. Would you like another cup of coffee? And a cookie or two to go with it? I have lemon snaps.
Hodges says yes to both.
9. Ollie. Janie says this, then falls silent long enough for Hodges to sip some of his new cup of coffee and eat a cookie. Then she turns to the window and the sailboats again, crosses her legs, and speaks without looking at him. Have you ever loved someone without liking them?
Hodges thinks of Corrine and the stormy 18 months that preceded the final split. Yes.
Then you'll understand. Ollie was my big sister, 8 years older than I was. I loved her. But when she went off to college, I was the happiest girl in America. And when she dropped out 3 months later and came running back home, I felt like a tired girl who has to pick up a big sack of bricks again after being allowed to put it down for a while. She wasn't mean to me, never called me names or pulled my pigtails or teased when I walked home from junior high holding hands with Marky Sullivan. But when she was in the house, we were always at condition yellow. Do you know what I mean?
Hodges isn't completely sure, but nods anyway.
Food made her sick to her stomach. She got rashes when she was stressed out about anything. Job interviews were the